What questions do you have about Wisconsin's forests, and how much fun can we have answering them for you this hour? I'm Lee Rayburn, and our next guests are the hosts of the SilvaCast podcast, produced by the Wisconsin Forestry Center at UW-Stevens Point. The podcast is now in its seventh season. It's got more than 100,000 downloads, with listeners on every continent except Antarctica so far. Our guests are Greg Edge, retired Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources forest ecologist and silviculturist, and Brad Hutnick, who is a Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources forest ecologist still. Welcome, gentlemen, to the both of you.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Yeah, we're glad to be here. And Greg, I'm sorry, I thought you got fired, so you're retired. Okay. All right.
Well, and
that's good.
That's what
good
the rumor is, at least.
Good to know.
Good to get an employment update out of the way. And if you would like a little bit of an idea of what kind of banter Greg and Brad have, I'll take you back to an episode earlier this season and just a little clip from the SilvaCast, where evidently Greg got the idea of listening to Terry Gross of Fresh Air and thought maybe they could sound a little bit like NPR. Here's Brad's response.
You want us to sound like an NPR story? I'm not even sure where to begin with that one, Greg, because there's like a whole host of reasons why we shouldn't do that. And let me point out, first of all, those people are professionals, right? Like you and I, what do? We don't do this professionally. This is like a labor of love. It's not a not a professional thing that we're doing.
We're professionals in a way.
I don't know, Greg.
Remind you, this is a Forest and Woodlands podcast.
Yeah.
But it is not public radio. Greg, let me ask you, because it's called the SilvaCast, and just among the public radio folks yesterday when asking around, they were unfamiliar with the term silviculture. So could you define silviculture for us?
I think my whole family is unfamiliar with the term silviculture, including my wife. So I like to describe it in maybe a more simplified version of it. And I say that silviculture is really the science and the practice of managing forest vegetation for any purpose. So there's a couple of things in there that I think are important. And that is we're managing the composition, the growth, the structure of forest vegetation to meet certain objectives. And those objectives could be all the way from growing straight, tall utility poles in a red pine plantation to managing the vegetation through prescribed burning to enhance the habitat for, say, an endangered species like Kirtland warbler or something like that. So it's a really broad science, and sometimes people refer to it as an art and a science because it's a little like medicine. We don't know everything there is to know about natural systems. And so we learn not only through research, but through practice and experience. And that's where foresters' field experience really comes into play.
Brad, where do you get your guests from? Because the most recent episode is speaking to an expert where in Hungary.
Yeah. You know, so Greg and I, we kind of go back and forth. And I think what we kind of use as a concept, if we think it's interesting, then someone else must find it interesting. We can't be that strange that someone else isn't going to find this same thing. Go, oh, that's really cool. And, you know, what's really impressive to me is that, you know, we're just two guys in Wisconsin and we call around or we send emails. And it's really cool how, like, we contact people in Hungary. We're talking to a gentleman in Germany on Friday. And every time we contact, and very few times or very, it's not very often that someone says, no, I will not be on the show. They're always like, hey, that sounds cool. Let's do it.
Yeah.
So, but we basically just come up with ideas, something that's coming up in research, something that's been coming up in conversations with foresters in the field, something we've been hearing about, or, you know, something that's sitting in the background. And we make a list every year. And then, Greg, we've actually gone through that list driving to, we go to North or South Dakota every year, and have 8 hours, and we basically have a lot of time to sort through things.
That is a long drive.
Sometimes I have to reel Brad in, though, because your ideas sometimes are... You know,
they might be out
far
there.
Gone.
But yeah, they're good, Greg. But they wind up being good in the end.
In the end. You have taken silviculture now with the Silvicast podcast, and you've created things like morticulture and beaviculture. And these have all become, episodes and segments and experts that you've been able to speak to. And I am impressed that you dove into the beaviculture of Wisconsin, because those are some hot waters right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think beavers can be, you know, depending on your perspective, they can be a problem or they can be a gift, right? And so it's all on your perspective. A hydrologist that I work with, who I really respect, kind of tells me about it. He says, you know, a mouse when you're walking through the woods is really cute, but a mouse in your basement becomes a problem. And it's kind of that same thing with beaver. It's all about context and perspective and how you're actually dealing with them. But yeah, you're right. It's a hot button issue.
And the expert that you had on the show, Greg, was talking about the things that we know about riverways largely are what we learned after the beaver population was decimated. And so we really don't have a good grasp of what the interaction, or we are beginning to have a better grasp of what the beaver role is in river habitats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think this whole issue around beavers really became widely known with that book. I believe it was Eager, The Secret Lives of Beavers, mm-hmm. and really kind of outlined how the fur trade decimated beaver populations across North America. So, as you said, people were looking at forest riparian areas along rivers and seeing a system that was without beavers. And so maybe not really a true picture of how those ecosystems worked. And Wisconsin's fortunate. We do have beaver populations that have been maintained and keep growing. But in western United States, those beavers were extirpated from large areas. So they really didn't know how that functioned in those ecosystems until more recent years, where those populations have rebuilt. So that show is really about kind of getting that conversation going with foresters about how beavers are impacting that system and how to work with them.
Correct.
Brad, if I understand correctly, you are one of the members of the Beaver Management Planning Committee. Be interested in knowing if this podcast helps informs your position. I know it's divisive. We brought it up a couple times on the show, and we get calls in both directions, And it seems like there could be some tough choices to make.
Well, actually, we did our podcast after the work of that committee was largely done.
Okay.
But it was informed by the discussions that I heard there about, and especially the guest we had, Dr. Emily Fairfax in Minnesota. She really did a beautiful job of laying out some of those things for the committee. That's one of those things where we're like, oh, she would make a fantastic person to kind of bring this to a larger audience of mm-hmm. forest practitioners who here are the people actually dealing with it, so they can have that, hear about that same thing as well.
It's a fascinating discussion, and I understand both sides of the argument, and you present them both in the most entertaining way possible. Yeah. And I hope it benefits the beaver and the people who are dealing with the beavers at the same time, mm-hmm. if that's possible. Greg Edge, and Brad Hutnick, our guest, the co-host of the Silvicast podcast. When's the next episode coming out?
We try to put out an episode once a month. It comes out during the first couple of days of the month. If we're on target, right, Brad?
Yep. You know, if we're on target, and this should be a shout out to our editor-in-chief, Susan Barrett. She does a fantastic job of corralling us, making sure we kind of get things done in the time frames we're supposed to.
So first of the month or thereabouts. If you get it together.
Yep. Yeah. And we try to do one a month, so 12 a year, and have been doing that now for 7 seasons.
Yeah.
If you have a question for our forest ecologists, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. As Ethan did, he would like you to describe how would you describe or make a group selection in larger practices for oak wilt, red pine pocket mortality, and other large-scale dieback events to landowners who are concerned about these large harvests and the regeneration timeline?
So was that how we might sell it or how we might design that?
How would you describe
it?
Yeah.
You know, I think, oh, I'm sorry. I'll let you go, Greg, and then
no,
I can correct you.
Yeah, no, 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 Brad.
Yeah, see, now he's going to correct me, so it's going to be one of those. Oh, boy, here we go. All right, but I'll just lay out the foundation. I think it's going to be context dependent. It's going to depend on how big that the Oakwell area is, or the, or even that like the pocket decline that you're looking at in the red pine. I think one of the things we've learned is that it's very hard to get ahead of these, right? So you could expand it out. Like we've often said, you know, leave one or two tree lengths outside of it, but you still oftentimes get some of that coming through. I would say the earlier the better. So if you can get a hold of when these things are very small and early, when you identify them as early as possible. And I know like some of the recent research has come out that if we actually look at like oak wilt and we only have five trees or four trees, you can actually do a kill the trees around them with herbicide, and you'll have a high probability of slowing that down and not getting into the rest of the stand. But once it gets beyond that, you might want to think about maybe just the other considerations that may be coming through, like the density of the stand, maybe a mix of species that you're leaving behind, things of that nature.
I think it's important also for context to remember those two things that he mentioned, pocket decline and red pine and oak wilt, are fungal, basically driven by fungal diseases that travel through the root systems of trees underground, so they can keep moving to their adjacent neighbors, forming bigger and bigger pockets. So what Brad is describing with the oak wilt and making a barrier out of herbicide killed stumps, you're basically trying to create that barrier and stop those fungal connections from spreading and becoming larger. So we've had some really good research in the state, particularly around that oak wilt, but also pocket decline and how to use silvicultural techniques to slow and stop those pockets. Although it's still, it's very difficult because you're dealing with an underground pathogen.
Ethan, thank you for the email and thank you for that answer. It makes sense to think under the soil. And it leads me to one of the other cultures that you have somehow created out of the Silvacast, Silviculture podcast, and that's morticulture. Is that something is that a term that actually exists in the science, or are you just adding culture to things?
It's not our term.
Okay.
Yeah, we did not coin that term, cannot take credit for it, but it's really cool.
It is. Yeah.
And you've got a whole podcast about it. And the premise, as I understand it, is a dead tree is just not truly dead. There are zombie trees.
You know, I think we've done a really good job in forestry of identifying that dead trees are important, and that we need to preserve them as a part of our management. And so very often you'll see a lot of prescriptions where we reserve dead trees. Morticulture goes kind of beyond that, and it says you should plan for having more dead trees over time through the life of that stand, because what you can see is if we do a harvest, we leave a couple dead trees behind, but we leave everything else, or we leave really sound, really good trees behind, that once that, I don't know, kind of blip of dead trees goes through, now you have a large part of that stand's history or stand's future where there won't be a lot of dead trees. And so it's how can you integrate that management just like you would integrate any other thing into your management? How can we have dead trees on hand over a longer period of time?
Yeah, it's kind of that evolution, right, of silvicultural thinking in the past, where we've done a good job of managing the living trees and trying to plan for the future long term. But morticulture just talks about we need to do that same thing for the dead trees, and because it's such a critical element to have in those forest systems. And I think our guest was describing the zombie trees as, in essence, some of those dead trees can actually have more living cells in them through things like decay fungi, insects, all the life that lives in a dead tree can have more living cells than when it was actually a living tree.
Right.
So that's where it comes in as being more alive than it was before.
But, okay, so I'm not a forest ecologist. I do love a forest. But when I hear stories of, like, the forest fires we've heard this summer, I've heard people blaming the dead trees as part of the problem. And I know you did a fire forest podcast earlier this season. And how does morticulture fit into the fire culture of our forests?
Well, historically, fire would have played, at least here in Wisconsin, it would have played a critical role in defining the composition and structure of forests across the state. And fire would have played a role in actually producing some dead trees or setting trees up for being dying in the future, right? Having an injury or something like that. Where we have these conditions, and we see it here maybe sometimes, but where you see it in other places where you get like a forest that's dead, then it's an abnormally large number of dead trees. That can really cause the problems that lead to really high intensity fires or something that probably was fairly uncommon historically.
Mm-hmm. I think we'll probably get into it more, but you'll hear Brad and I talk a lot about the importance of disturbance in driving how a forest functions. And it's very important, whether it's fire or wind or insect and disease, to have those disturbances within a forest. It's really, with today's issue with wildfires, is really a matter of scale. So we're talking about fires that are larger and more severe than maybe we have seen historically. Maybe not in Wisconsin, because we're not quite as fire prone of a landscape, but obviously people have been listening to the stories on the news. So the Canadian boreal forest, for example, or the western pine forest, places where they've had events like large-scale mortality of trees due to mountain pine beetle, which populations have boomed beyond historical numbers because of a warmer climate. And so you have a large number of dead trees, then you have more fuel in the system, so you can get larger fires. So we really have to talk about the specifics or the context of the forest that we're dealing with when we talk about these fire issues, because they can be quite complex.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting, Greg, too. I think you were knobs on with disturbance is kind of that thing that drove everything, right? So whether it was flooding, whether it was wind, our trick as foresters is to look at what that natural disturbance or cultural disturbance, right? Because we know that, you know, Native Americans lit a lot of fires. And so whatever that disturbance was, and it basically produced the landscape we had. If we want elements of that to continue, how do we mimic that? How do we use that? Or how does it inform our current management? And that's where the cool part comes in, because we don't really have all the answers on that yet. So we really need to be experimenting and trying a lot of different things in order to get closer to kind of some better outcomes in the future.
Let's go to your questions now for our guests, Greg Edge and Brad Hutnick, the hosts of the SilvaCast podcast. And we'll start with Wendell in Peshtigo. Hi, Wendell.
Hello. I'm glad you could put us on. I've got two things to mention. One are our observations this year with the jack pine in a walking trail we have near Marinette. And we looked it up, and it's a jack pine resin midge. And there's a real work on particularly the new growth of the year. I'm wondering if our forester can say anything about whether they occur in sort of waves, or there's some years better than others. It doesn't appear to be killing the whole tree, but it totally disfigures the new growth of this jack pine. My other comment has to do with cutting that we had in the Blackwoods Natural Area in just down the road in Marinette, between Marinette and Peshtigo. This was a wonderful woods with a lot of well-developed older jack pine, and we're really disappointed the forester just came in and totally clear-cut that area. More and more we're hearing about the role and importance of older trees. This was an excellent area for deer hunters and people in general, and I'm sort of surprised that such a cutting would go on. And maybe that there wasn't maybe more of an opportunity for the public to express an interest or a disinterest in the cutting there.
Wendell, thank you for the call. And the sirens you hear are on your radio, just so you know. So the jack pine resin midge.
So I love jack pine. Yeah, so, and I was just going to say, Wendell's in luck because that is Greg's favorite tree.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. And we try to, you know, we have
some,
you're
some
part
people
of a 12-step
call it
process
a,
for that,
people,
right, Greg?
Yeah, some people yeah. diss Jack Pine. They call it a sad, scrubby tree.
Yeah.
But it's actually ecologically really amazing tree.
Yeah.
So, so with that, Brad, do you want me to take a stab at Wendell's question?
Sure.
Or two
and then,
questions.
Yeah. Yeah, two questions. So you could take the first part if you want.
So the first one with midges, and that's, to be honest, there are a ton of insects that impact all trees. Midges is one of them. I'm not totally familiar with that particular midge, and generally speaking, it's probably not a large threat to the jack pine that are in his area. It may be causing some damage to the new growth and tissue, but midges generally are not as a huge disturbance factor. The big one that we always think about and always monitor in jack pine is jack pine budworm, which historically booms in some years. The population goes up and can kill large areas of jack pine. And that's, as Brad was talking about, is one of those natural disturbances in jack pine systems. And the thing to remember about jack pine is historically, it's one of the...
Oh, I think we just lost your connection there.
Yep. Oh, Greg, you're on. Yep, you're muted.
Historically, you were saying...
Oh, yeah. Am I back?
Yeah.
Yep, you're back.
Yeah, so historically, jack pine regenerated and grew through fire disturbance.
Oh.
Because fire is what released most of the seed in those cones and prepared a seed bed for it.
Huh.
And so because we as humans have suppressed fire in much of the state, our jack pine forests have been shrinking. We've been losing acres right. every year in jack pine. And that's because it just doesn't regenerate naturally without fire. So sometimes as foresters, as silviculturalists, we have to find a surrogate for that fire. And the typical one through jack pine is Wendell's second part of the question. And that is we clear cut or we remove the trees from a large area, disturb the soil so you get that seed bed, and you put the cones from the crowns close to the ground, and instead of fire opening those cones, just the heat close to the ground will open those, they're called serotonous cones, and release that seed. So oftentimes that harvesting surrogate for fire is really stark. It's a big cut, and
it's noticeable to Wendell. He sees it.
Totally yeah. noticeable, but I don't know his particular case, but it may be that that forester is trying to regenerate that jack pine, knowing that we can't introduce fire into that system there.
Yeah, and you know, in some ways too, Greg, I mean, as foresters, we kind of have to take a really long-term approach to management. And mm-hmm. so we have to have that timing involved. And so as I think, Greg, you would maybe agree, it's not a really short-term species, but it's not like growing a white oak or a white pine, right, which we can grow for hundreds of years. A jack pine is going to be relatively short-lived. And so the disturbance that gave us jack pine is going to be different than other places. And so a forester, to me, it sounds like they're trying to do something, and it's actually probably mimicking even a little bit of what historically occurred with jack pine. Taking a long-term approach, we have a short term, we have to look at that problem, or at least maybe the aesthetics, but long term, maybe we're sustaining jack pine, which sustains habitat for a lot of species that we really want. So we kind of have to take one for the team in some ways.
Wendell, yeah. It's a great explanation. And Wendell, I think that might mean there are more jack pines in your future in your area. And thank you for the call. Mike, we're going to get to you in just a couple of minutes, but our guests are the co-hosts of the Silvicast podcast. All things forestry management presented in the most fun way possible with experts from across the world. And there are guests, Greg Edge and Brad Hutnick, answering your questions at 1-800-642. That's 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also email us talk@WPR.org. And we'll get back to your questions for our guests next. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to WPR News. Silviculture. It is the science and practice of managing forest vegetation for any purpose. Our guests are the hosts of the Silviculture podcast called Silvicast. Greg Edge is a retired DNR forest ecologist. Brad Hutnick, still a DNR forest ecologist. And we are answering your questions about forest ecology and silviculture today at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And let's get right to Mike and Madison, who's been hanging on. Mike, hi.
Hi, guys. I had a quick comment for forest fire information. In the past, we harvested lots and lots of, up to 100 years ago, all humans harvested tons and tons of wood for all of our heating and cooking. And the majority of that was done with standing dead because it's instantly burnable. And having lived off grid in a house where my heat and my cooking was all done by wood, it's amazing how much standing dead you'll clear out of the woods in a year. But we don't really have that much anymore, so most of our standing dead is standing there, and the loggers don't want any of the standing dead. The standing dead has become more of an issue here recently, just because we just don't harvest the standing dead like we used to make use of the fire for heating and cooking. Now, I know our family cabin, a 120-year-old family cabin in the Northwoods, Wisconsin here, still has a wood-burning cook stove and a wood-burning fireplace to heat and get things done. And we go through a fair amount of wood only using that place for the late spring, summer, and early fall. But still go through quite a bit of wood. So just as a basic history lesson, having lived the off-grid lifestyle, we used to use a lot of standing dead, but we don't really go through much of it as a species, as humans anymore.
And as a result, what do you see do you attribute forest fires to these standing dead, Mike?
I don't necessarily, because the majority of our forest fires now are caused by man-made. But when they do come through, there is more. I know when I lived in Colorado, we had a few forest fires come through, and it did hit the standing dead pretty heavily, especially through the aspen forest where there's plenty of standing dead, and it burns really quick and nice and hot. But once again, the forest fire is sort of a natural thing. We need some of it, as you were just talking about the jack pines.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a fire can be good, but I really don't attribute much of our catastrophic fires to the standing dead.
I appreciate that. And I think we kind of touched on this with morticulture. Standing dead almost sounds like the walking dead, which goes back to a morticulture of our forests.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. That reminded me of a thing I saw recently in Europe, and people prior to us would oftentimes go into the woods, girdle trees, and leave them standing for a year so that they would dry out, and then they could come in and harvest them and basically be able to burn them fairly quickly when they came down, so they didn't have to have large stacks on hand that were drying. They were already dried. And I think, though, you know, like the thing with a lot of this is that I think we've really recognized, you know, it's context dependent, but that dead wood in a forest really plays a critical role for a lot of different species. And even I was just out the other day, a shout out to foresters for the DNR, because they're some of we always get calls from them with questions and just some really cool discussions. But we were over by Mill Bluff State Park looking at yellow birch regeneration, and where there was yellow birch, where you found the regeneration were on dead trees that had basically rotted down, had a moss cover on them, and then the seedlings were able to get established on that nurse log. And so we haven't talked about that context yet, but oftentimes for hemlock, yellow birch, things of that nature, it's a really critical component of trying to perpetuate and sustain those types of trees in the future. So I think it's all context, and it's all about the amount that we actually need. Too much is too good, or is not a good thing. Too little is not a good thing either.
There's a balance, and nature creates it on its own most often, and we can upset that balance ourselves through inaction or action, I'd imagine. We seem to be the X factor here.
Well, and Brad and I have worked with a lot of landowners over the years, and we always encourage landowners who are burning wood to utilize wood within their woodlands, whether that's dead wood or say tops from a harvest or something like that. I think the message is, as Brad was saying, is we need some of it. So, so don't think about it like cleaning the woods of all things dead, because those are good things. To have standing dead trees, which foresters call snags, or down logs, which we call coarse woody debris, that those are important parts of the forest. So it really is about that balance.
Yeah. Mike, thank you for the call. We'll go to Joel in Middleton next. Hi, Joel.
Hi there. My question is about the role of fungi in forest management. Perhaps they are as essential to forest development and their role in morticulture. And there's a side question that goes along, a couple of things that go along with this. One is forest fires in eastern Oregon, where I live for a number of years, were normally caused by the planting of inappropriate species years ago. And so they easily burned. But that's a side issue. And then the other thing has to do with fungus and the role of rotting fish on fish banks. And so I'll listen to your response to those.
Fungus, yep. Rotting fish and inappropriate plants.
Wow. Yeah. We were working on the what are called the biomass harvesting guidelines a number of years ago. And what I mean by that is when we harvest a forest and we harvest the whole tree and basically grind it up and use it for lots of different things, we're harvesting not only the log and the pulp wood, but we're harvesting the whole biomass. And the reason we're developing guidelines is because it's important, again, to leave dead wood within the forest and to have that within the system, those nutrients to continue functioning. And one thing that really struck me by looking at that research is just the vast diversity of fungi that are in a forest. And in those guidelines, we developed specifications for how much fine wood you should leave and coarse wood you should leave, how many, you know, leaving appropriate amount of different species, because there are different fungi that grow on different size pieces of wood, grow on specific species of dead wood. It's just like this amazing world that we just see glimpses of within the forest. Yep. And in Europe, where for centuries they've done, you know, more of a utilization and cleaning of their forest, they actually have fungi that are in danger that they don't see anymore because they've removed those particular pieces of substrate that the fungi live on. So it is a really amazing branch of forest ecology.
And it's something that I would guess we're going to be hearing a lot more about in the future. You know, we know Susan Samar, the mother tree, there. We know that there are relationships between fungi and trees in basically sharing resources. And we don't know the exact context. We don't know how much, you know, like there's a lot of stuff that's still, we don't know because it's so hard to learn about, you know, like we can't just go out and do, like we can do sampling in the woods, we can count seedlings. When we start to do fungi and looking into the soil, that's a lot harder. That's something that, like Greg, you and I can't do, but someone specialized has to do that. And so I think that's a place where, as we go forward, we're gonna hear a lot more about the relationship of different fungi to different types of management that we implement.
What about the role of rotting fish? Does that have a place? I would imagine it provides some nutrients.
Greg, you live in La Crosse, so you know, you're right on the Mississippi, you know all about rotting fish, right?
Yeah, well, it's usually my dog is finding those things, unfortunately. It all goes back into the system. And that's important.
Yeah. And when it comes to inappropriate plants, I think of your most recent podcast, where your expert from Hungary is making the case for the black locust, which has gotten a bad rap.
Oh, boy. Greg and I are going to...
I'm going to let... Yeah, Brad and I are going
to... Nobody wants to tackle
it. All right, on this issue, but...
all right, I'll tiptoe through this one. So,
Brad.
Yeah. Okay, so black locust is not native to Wisconsin. And it's native to like central United States. and the Appalachians and some other places. But it's planted all over the world because it's a clonal species. Once you establish it, it grows back very easily. And it's very rot resistant. So like we were talking about firewood, if you plant this in a place where people still depend on firewood, it has a high BTU value. So you could create a lot of firewood and sustain a lot of fires just by using black locust. The problem is that it grows in, it's I don't know if aggressive is the right term, but if we leave it in the open, it will regenerate. Basically, through its roots, it will regenerate, just like aspen will regenerate through its root system, you know, basically coming off of that. And so Greg and I go back, this is the kind of discussion that kind of led to SilvaCast, because we would argue about this stuff in the truck or sitting in a hotel room at night getting ready for work the next day. You know, with this one, it's kind of I always look at it as, if you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with. So in some places, we may just have to live with it, and how do we live with it? And that's kind of I think if it's in a prairie or if it's in a high-quality area, for sure we have to get rid of it. Mm-hmm. But there'll be lots of places where it's just one more thing. We don't necessarily have to go out and march out and kill it right now. We can kill it over a longer period of time or work it into our management over a longer period of time.
Brad's just enamored with black locust because he's got it in his backyard. So I'm just saying.
If you smell the blossoms in the spring,
I'm sure there's some restoration ecologists out there who are just cringing right now because they've been trying to get rid of the black locust in, say, a savanna or a prairie. And it is a very disturbance-dependent species. So sometimes the more you disturb it, the more you get back. It's a tough thing to control.
Right. And like I was saying, if it's in a area you're trying to change this, then yeah, by all means, get rid of it, you know, destroy it. But you have to use a lot of herbicide. You have to do a lot of other things. So I think it's more of just context dependent. Is this the place you need to kill it? Or do you really want to focus on those areas where you're going to get the biggest results?
And for the full debate and the expert's take, you can certainly check out the latest episode of the SilvaCast podcast with our guests, Greg Edge and Brad Hutnick. Greg is a retired DNR forest ecologist. Brad is still a DNR forest ecologist in our conversation. You can join us. Why do I keep saying it like that?
I don't know. We'll see.
I think it's the way you introduce yourself in every episode, Brad.
I love the way you emphasize still.
Because, well, after that locust discussion,
Brad,
I don't know.
Brad says he's never going to be able to retire, I'm going to hold him to that.
Yeah.
He's going to be out there with his walker in the woods.
That's right.
Giving people... advice.
I appreciate it. 1-800-642-1234 if you'd like to join our conversation. You can email us talk@wpr.org. I do believe that the most recent episode talking about black locust is the one where Brad gets the electrodes. So it's not like...
what we do for the craft, right?
You'll have to hear that audio for yourself. Let's go to Ryan in Upson next. Hi, Ryan.
Hi. So I have had a couple of questions here. So I have some land in northern Wisconsin up here in Upson, and in 2029 I have a prescription for. A thinning of one section is a thinning, another section is a clear cut. And I was listening to where you guys were talking about with jack pines and everything. And since fire's not, you know, a very good viable option to help with the jack pine reforestation, maybe if that would be a good option for reforestation after the clear cut. So I've one in 2029, another one in 2031. And currently, there's a lot of spruce and red maple and things in that stand. So do you think jack pine would be a good option for reforestation? And would that be on the loggers on completion of their work? Or would that be on me when they're done?
Greg, you said that these jack pine are ecologically amazing. What should Ryan do?
One thing that is important to really remember is that forests are very diverse, and the species that grow in particular forests are going to be dependent on what the soil is like, first of all. So what the moisture and nutrients are on those particular soils. So I'm not sure what his specific site is like and what his soils. Jackpine grows on very particular, very dry, nutrient-poor sands. So we see our jackpine growing in our northwest sands up in, say, Bayfield, Douglas County, our northeast sands over by Marinette, and our central sands around, say, Stevens Point, kind of in that hub of Wisconsin. So outside of those areas, soils tend to get more rich, although they can be varied. And it's really important for him to start looking at, hopefully he has a forestry plan that delineates sort of what the forest type is, what the soils are like, and what kinds of trees and tree species would grow best there. So that's where you need to start. What types of trees are best adapted to that site, and how should they be regenerated? And another important thing to remember is the vast majority of forests in Wisconsin are regenerated or regrown naturally through natural regeneration, not through planting. Planting is just a very small segment of how we regenerate forests.
Yeah.
And so that's where those techniques, those silvicultural techniques come into play to try to regenerate the species that are appropriate to the site. So my advice to him is to start with your local DNR forester, look at if you have a management plan, which it sounds like he does because he has things prescribed in the coming years, and to talk with them about the plan and what the most appropriate course of action is and regeneration is on those sites. Okay. I'm kind of thinking, Brad, it might not be jackpine up there.
If it's spruce and red maple now, it could be a little more moist.
A little moist, yeah.
Yeah. So, just like you said, site assessment, you know, is going to tell you everything you need to know about what's going to do best on that site. So it may or may not do well, but local experts can help you with that. One thing, though, the logger would not be responsible for doing any tree planting. So that's going to be on you, but that can be contracted. Other people can do that, and you can buy seedlings through our state nurseries, really high quality seedlings through our state nursery of a lot of different species. Once you decide which direction you're going to go with, if that's one of the tools that you're going to use, it's a really good place to get them.
Ryan, thank you for the call, and I hope that gives you some direction. Let's go to Jan and Madison next. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I have a question because we live just west of the city, Middleton Township, off Old Sauk Road, and the Johnstown Moraine, which sort of connects with the Ice Age Trail, which is a little farther west on Old Sauk Road. But we have a small portion that I would like to donate to when we move and leave our house, donate to somebody or so it doesn't get built on. And I want to know if there's anybody that you could recommend that I call to find out how to get that accomplished.
You know, I think a good place to start with that would be to, and just a shout out, Driftless Land Conservancy might be a great place. If they don't have the answer, they can direct you to maybe someone, another group that may be able to take care of that for you. But I think that's a great idea. If you're able to do that, I think it's a fantastic idea.
Yeah.
Another resource, I think, is maybe worth looking up, and I don't know who the person is covering that area, but the DNR has a small number of land agents that deal with things like purchases around state lands and so on. And they are really well versed in like some of the real estate issues and conservancy easement issues. Might be just another resource for someone to talk to.
So the local DNR agent here, Jan, in the Madison area, as well as the Driftless Conservancy, would at least be able to point you in the right direction.
Yeah, I think so. Yep.
Thank you for the call. Let's go to Jim in Appleton next. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Lee. Thanks for taking my call. So I live in Appleton, but we have a family farm right on the Pine River near Poissippi, Wisconsin. It's really sandy on this farm. It's a 90-acre plot of land. I would say half of it is forest, half of it is fields. We currently grow alfalfa and hay, but I want to start a small Christmas tree operation. I tried planting about 125 Fraser fir and Douglas fir blue spruce, and they didn't quite make it through the winter. I'm just wondering, is that the right species? Do I need to have irrigation? I guess any help in the right direction would be great.
Brad?
Well, Greg's our local expert on Appleton because, Greg, you're a product of Appleton.
Maybe, yeah.
So we won't hold it against Jim for being from Appleton.
Yeah, no, hey.
Hey, no. Hey,
go, no. Go yeah. Appleton West.
Yeah,
what my advice, okay, Christmas tree growing is kind of a unique sort of niche around sort of forestry and agriculture. So my advice to him would be, one, is to look to your extension, UW Extension and extension agents, because they put out some really nice material on for Christmas tree growers and things like Christmas tree pests, and address all of those. Whether or not he's lost those trees because they were the wrong species, Christmas trees, you only have to grow for, say, what, 7 to 10 years?
Yeah, right.
Someone that, so they don't have to live 100 years on a site. So there's more flexibility, right? But the reason you lose seedlings could be widely varied, from we have a severe drought, right, that kills your new seedling, to there wasn't enough control of that grass and alfalfa, because that can really suck a lot of moisture and nutrients away from seedlings, to deer browse issues are always an issue. So I think another step is to really diagnose maybe why he lost those species before he replants, to kind of see if he can mitigate maybe what those issues are. But yeah, look at some of the Christmas tree resources from Extension, and you got to keep trying.
Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic can help nail down what went wrong with those trees.
And I think even talking to people locally that you may want to just go meet, who are also growing Christmas trees in your area. But I think you're right, Greg. UW Extension is going to be a wealth of knowledge on that. And local foresters may have some knowledge about that as well. And it may be even, you know, that some of the species you're looking at aren't going to be right. You know, balsams are grown over a large part of central and northern Wisconsin for Christmas trees, other species. So the answer's out there. You just have to go find it.
Hey, Jim, thanks for the call. And I hope you follow up with us, because I'd be interested in knowing how you fare. And if you get a Christmas, it's good to know somebody who's got a Christmas tree farm. So let us know how you're doing down the road. You know, we started this conversation today with a clip from your podcast, The Silva Cast, where you were wondering whether or not you were public radio material. Gentlemen, I believe over this last hour, we have answered that question clearly.
Yeah. I'm not sure I've got a job when we're done, so I got to find that out first. So
I've apparently been fired. So
yeah. So it's
I said retired, right? I didn't get that wrong.
No, he's retired.
All right.
I guess the world will know now. Yes, he's retired. So
I suppose.
I'll still tell people you were fired, though, Greg. So it's okay.
I'm gonna go talk to human resources, see if we have any openings available, see if we can get Greg and Brad in here, because although they didn't think so, they are clearly public radio material, gentlemen.
Oh boy,
it is. It's been a pleasure. I very much appreciate you handling all the answers for all of our callers and emailers today. And I want to invite you back again to public radio, because you belong here.
Hey, anytime.
I want to get some lessons from you, Lee, about those transitions, because they're way smoother.
Yes. I appreciate that immensely. Those are the things I generally are kicking myself for at the end of the show.
Just listen to ours.
Greg Edge and Brad Hutnick, they are the hosts of the Silva Cast podcast, and we'll be sure to have them back. I'm the host of the Lee Rayburn Show, and thanks to our team today, Clara Neipert, Joel Patenaud, Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau, and thank you as well for being a part of the show. You're listening to WPR News.